Welcome to the Final Draft Podcast. My name is Andrew Popel, and today I'm joined on the show by Miranda Darling. Now, the Final Draft Podcast is all about books, writing, and literary culture. It's a chance every week to tune in to the best of new Australian writing, from debut authors to the classics that you know and love. These conversations are a way to look at the issues that drive the author's storytelling, a way to discover more from these incredible books, because these are the stories that make us who we are. Now, 2SER broadcasts from the lands of the Gadigal people, and I record on the lands of the Darug and the Gunungurra people. I want to acknowledge the traditional owners of those lands, pay my respects to their ongoing connection to their lands, acknowledging that these are unceded lands and that treaty has never been made with Australia's First Nations. I'm joined on the show today by Miranda Darling. Miranda is a writer, a poet. She's the co-founder of Vanishing Pictures. She has done just some incredible things, and her writing will look, we're going to be talking about her fifth book, Thunderhead, where across a single day we are thrown into the life of Winona Dalloway. This sort of deep study, this travelling alongside a character so closely, offers enormous opportunity to discover. And this is a lyrical book. It is a tremendous read. It has so much to show us. It's my pleasure to be bringing it to you today. So join me as we discover Miranda Darling's Thunderhead. It is my pleasure to be welcoming Miranda Darling. Miranda is a writer, a poet, co-founder of Vanishing Pictures. She has published both fiction and non-fiction, and today she is joining us with her new novel. It is called Thunderhead. Miranda, it is a pleasure. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me, Andrew.
Now, across a single day, we are thrown into the life of Winona Dalloway. From the moment she wakes, stealing a few precious moments before her time is not her own, to the dinner party that looms over her calendar, the reader follows Winona as she simply tries to be herself. And so, Miranda, like, I truly loved Thunderhead, and I'm tempted to describe Winona as a true original. But before I let like our whole conversation to kind of descend into hyperbole, I stopped myself and I wondered about that reaction, about the access that you give us to Winona's world. And is it that Winona is so unique, or is there perhaps an element that women and women's inner worlds are simply not subjects that are given enough time and ink?
It's a very good question, and I think it's both. I think that we all contain multitudes, and we all have our outer persona. We walk around, we shop, we do this, we do that, and inside we're teeming with all sorts of conversations, conflicting thoughts, and no one has access to that apart from the person living in that head. And so I suppose with Winona, I wanted to create something where you really saw that schism between the outer and the inner world, and the way that the inner world, in her case, is louder than the outer world. We're sort of, in a way, engulfed in her inner weather, and outside it's actually calmer than on the inside. And I think it's about asking people to consider that the person passing you in the street is teeming just like you with these multitudes. So whether she's, I mean, I think she is an unusual character in that for her, this is very, very alive. But I think that people are seeing their own inner worlds reflected a bit in that. So I think she's unique, but she's also a bit all of us.
I mean, something that is very unique is, and I got this from the outset, that Winona is an observer of her own life. She observes, time has scattered, it is fragmented, and I can no longer see the full picture of things. I have lost where I am up to in life. Now, she is subject to the pull of many voices, some even her own. I wondered if you could talk, though, about this sense that I got of her losing her agency.
Well, I think for her, time has stopped inside her, stopped moving in a linear fashion. That's this idea of the fragmentation. For her, it's sort of circular, and she no longer has her points of reference, because the external points of reference she doesn't relate to, she resists, or in fact, they are a form of the oppression she's seeking to escape. So she has to kind of release herself from that. So then she has these internal points of reference, which are just her own impressions, her own emotions, her sensibilities. And so we're having this sort of like almost a whirlpool of emotions and sense of being in the world. So she doesn't understand where her feet are. quite literally. And so, so she doesn't understand what she's supposed to be feeling, where she's supposed to be up to in her life. The external narrative that's sort of imposed, you know, the chronological time, the time of the spreadsheets, the text messages, the orders, the diaries, it doesn't apply to her, it doesn't make sense to her. And so she's struggling to find a way in which she can make sense of herself outside of the imposed strictures, but, you know, with adding a bit more order to the chaos that she's experiencing within herself.
I guess a lot of us can relate to that idea of external and internal structures, the way they impose themselves on our lives. I really hope we get into this a little bit more in a sec, but I wanted to think a little bit about how you realize that on the page. And there is a lot to explore structurally in Thunderhead. We follow Winona through a single day, so there is a structure where I guess nothing and everything all at once seems to be happening. The action and indeed the tension, though, it explodes less through the events and more through Winona's own wrestling. Wrestling with those events, wrestling with her perspectives and the voices that are talking to her about her life. How did you land on this? And maybe talk, can you talk to this in both a stylistic but also a visual sense? How did you land on this style and structure in telling Winona's story?
Well, I think I drove the typesetters a little mad because we were trying to make it so that it was very clear on the page for the reader and not to be jumping too much with fonts and things like that as well. So for me, it was very clear. There are, I think, five voices and they all have a very different tone, approach, life attitude, advice or sort of message for Winona. So the voices are very clear for me inside. And so I wanted the voices to be very clearly distinct on the page, but not distractingly so. So we've used similar fonts, but some bold, some italicized, and so on. And if you go all the way through, you'll notice that what are very, very disparate voices speaking actually start to come together and coalesce and become almost one voice towards the end of the book, which is the point at which she can take some different kind of action. So it was very carefully thought out. And the structure of the 24 hours, I suppose, or one day, was very important to kind of contain the teeming multitude that is Winona, and also the lists. So the lists are very, very pragmatic, practical ways of grounding her in a time and place. She does it for herself. She grounds herself, but I think it also grounds the reader. It allows us to sort of take a breath from the whirling and the wonder and say, okay, tuna, olive oil, and sort of really just bring things down to something digestible, a bit of a pause in a way. So, yeah, that creates all the different pacing as well. The book is very important to me.
I loved it. And as much as I feel for the typesetters, I would have to nod to the fact that, like, perhaps even avoiding the confusion was, I don't know, I enjoyed the confusion and I actually found, and we're talking about typesetting, Miranda, so I don't think this is a spoiler, but I found myself at the end of the book and I'd read a couple of pages, you know, we're about 5-6 pages from the end. And I just went, oh, hello. And I went back and I said, yes. And I'd noticed that we were in that sort of uniform typeset. And I thought, okay. And it was such an embodied signaling of what was happening. It also, I wonder if anyone else has reflected this yet, but I found myself wanting to go back and try to piece together some sort of sense of each of the typeset voices, like, who is this person? Is it the forceful? Is it the innocent? And it was a tremendous, I guess, embodied reading experience.
Well, I love that you wanted to unpick that, because, you know, in a way, when I went through, I highlighted each one with a different color for the typesetter, so we knew who was saying what. And so each one does have a character, and you can actually unpick it and do it in reverse or reread it with a view to, you know, noting that the bowl is always the very sort of the quite harsh voice, or, you know, you can really have a look. And I hope it's very, very clear, the different the tonalities and characteristics of the different voices.
And, of course, all of that is framed again, or perhaps we should say that Winona is the one doing the framing around the fact that Winona is a novelist. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how storytelling and working out the world through stories fits into Thunderhead.
So it's very important to me, because I remember when I used to work on film scripts, they always said, you know, whoever has the best story wins, right? And I think that's very true in life. And if we can tell ourselves the stories that we're happy to believe, we can almost get through anything. The narrative is important. It also comes down to who controls the narrative and who gets listened to. And Winona has tried on various narrative capes, in a sense, and none of them fit. And so she's looking for the one that's going to make sense of her situation. She is yet to find it. The fact that she's a romance novelist, so she is, that's another cape. She's trying to fit her life into something like the romance she writes. And it's obviously an ill-fitting cape in this situation as well. So she really, it's a sort of, it's a narrative death in her personal life. It's a narrative death in the work she's trying to do. And this idea of struggling to make sense of the events that, you know, seem to her rather overwhelming is reflected in both her work as a writer and as a person trying to get through the day.
Now, at the risk, and I definitely do not want to do this, Miranda, of getting both our audiences offside, dear readers, how important is the reader, or how important should the reader be? Because it strikes me as Winona is trying on these, you use the allusion, they're capes, trying on these capes, trying on these ideas of stories that might help her make sense. Where they perhaps fall down, and even when she's conceptualizing her own novel, is will the reader believe it? So there is a sense that authenticity only works insofar as an outside observer observes it to be authentic, and then is it authentic? And we can whirl, again, we whirl around that idea and perhaps never make sense of it.
Yes, no, that's true. But I think that what I hope, the reader is crucial to this book, don't mean to any book really, but because it must come alive inside of them. Mm. So in a way, for me, it's a book that you almost feel rather than read. So you absorb it. And so I'm hoping to invite the reader into this world where all these questions are raised and they're complicit. Mm. Because they're complicit in the sense that they are also making a story out of these disparate parts, just as she is. There's yet another story making going on. And then there's also this idea of being complicit in, you know, when something happens, like the book is funny, right? So I think it's funny. It's meant to be quite humorous as well as dark. So when something humorous happens, you know, we laugh along with her, and then suddenly sometimes there's a textual sucker punch. Do we keep laughing? Are we complicit in the humiliation of Winona, or are we? So there's, I mean, I always like to play push me, pull you with the reader in that respect, to saying, where do you position yourself? You know, I'm not telling, I'm just showing and allowing them to come for their own experience of the book.
And there is a tremendous opportunity for identification because, as we have discussed, there are so many facets to Winona. There are so many facets to all of us, but perhaps we don't acknowledge that. We keep that sense of a cohesive whole, but different readers can identify differently with Winona at different points and even at different moments within a single scene, which is, it really is quite wonderful. I like the use of the word complicit, though. I feel like readers should embrace the idea that they are complicit in the action that they are enjoying.
Absolutely. I mean, they are invited in. She wants them to come into their world. They're invited in to make their own sense of it and to maybe see some of their own experiences reflected on an emotional level, or even on a level of feeling confused about things, or sudden sharp recognition of what it's like to drive in traffic and to feel seen. And there's this sense that, like, we are legion, you know, we are all alone, but we're also not alone. If we read, we can kind of realize that we're not. And there's that reaching out that is part of, in a way, why I write. Mm.
We talked about this off air. We have come to the point where I'm going to have to ask about Virginia Woolf. From the moment that Winona sets out to buy flowers, through the fact of the action contained in a single day, I felt Woolf exerting some pull on the narrative. Now, Virginia Woolf's Mrs. Dalloway, if I'm not wrong, precedes the action of Thunderhead by almost a century. This could almost be a centenary nod to Mrs. Dalloway. This is a modernist classic. It did so much for the novel. What does Virginia Woolf mean to you? How has this bled through your narrative?
Well, I love Virginia Woolf. I love the modernists. It's definitely was a very much an overt influence. So like you said, it takes place in one day. Her surname is Dalloway as well. There's even a little quote at the front about the great revelations that come as sparks. And what I suppose the thing that ties it most closely perhaps is the portrayal of the domestic experience as something completely extraordinarily rich, I suppose, like the minutiae of every day and all the things that whirl around it. So Virginia Woolf's sort of idea of the quiet lives of women and the women's writing and all of that, her essays influenced me a lot. I suppose that's fed into the book a lot. Say, how do we, you know, this is not about battles, kings and elephants. This is about supermarkets and car runs and sitting at home and wondering whether the oysters fit on the plate properly. It's these tiny things that from that we can extrapolate worlds. And I think that's something that, that she was doing. And then also in works like The Waves, when she was using many, many voices and very innovative techniques to create that feeling in the author, in the reader. I think that's something that probably influenced me a lot as well.
So much. Okay, where do we go? I've got so many questions I want to ask. Ah, we're going to jump around a little bit now, Miranda, so please forgive me. Winona observes that there are severe consequences for mothers who don't fit the mold. And this sense of who women are, what women can be, where they are going, what they should be. I mean, this was very much a concern through a novel like Mrs. Dalloway. For Winona, though, this sense of agency, how does her sense of agency, her sense of maybe not fitting into the story that she currently finds herself in, how does that play with the expectation of that story? What did you want to address about these idea of roles and expectations?
Well, I think I wanted to break open the idea that there is anyone who's feeling like they are fitting perfectly well in their role and that's it. I feel like certainly from my experience and my experience talking to other friends and a lot of mothers especially, there's a deep insecurity that we're not doing it right and someone's going to find out and are we a bad mother and, you know, are we... I always used to say you can never get the balance right. If you work and mother, you either work too much and you're a bad mother, you mother too much and you're a bad person. Like it's sort of, no one's ever got the balance right for more than 5 minutes. And anyone who says they does is probably not telling the truth, but that's also for a reason that might be really important to them as well. So there's this whole, there's so many layers of seems to be and the actual experience and what we're supposed to feel and I think that's, it's so rich to mine that because it's not just motherhood that brings that, but I think it's a particularly emotive one that has particular pressures and it seems to be a really wonderful way to showcase those things.
Mm. One of the ways this plays out, and it occurs to me, Miranda, you'll forgive me for a moment, that usually when I talk about mental health on the show, I do give a little bit of a content warning. So I will let listeners know that if discussions around mental health are not something that you are need right now in your life, that we might do, you might take a break from the next couple of minutes of the conversation and know that help is always available through Lifeline 131114. But on that, one of the ways this plays out is in, I guess, discussions of Winona's mental health, which feels like it is both an open question and almost like it is anyone's business but her own. It's a thing that is unnamed, but also when it is named, it's a thing to be hidden. Did you want here to be reflecting society's, I guess I might call it society's still fraught relationship with mental health and mental ill health?
Yeah, but certainly. I mean, I think I wanted to blur the lines. I feel, and in the entire book, it's sort of a bit of a mission to say that categories are not always helpful and that things might fit into a box, but they probably won't fit very well and you probably have to squash them and maybe cut off a hand and a foot to get in there. And so because we're so fond of needing something to be digestibly presented to be able to cope with it. And so many things, in fact, most of the world, it's not possible to do that. And you can do great harm by trying to label everything and then in certain cases, weaponize that. And so I wanted to look, I suppose, at the fact that we can put a very black and white name on something, but that does not describe the experience. And I wanted to, in a way, to crumble away at the foundations of the things that we take to be absolutely true. You know, a doctor's opinion or this or that. It's like, but let's ask that question. Is it really? And sort of create questions more than anything, create questions around all these things and to say that we are all very neurodiverse, some more than others. I count myself as quite neurodiverse. And I think it's really important to explore the ways in which that is experienced by someone going through a quote-unquote normal day. Because I think it's something, degrees of that are shared amongst a lot of the population.
It is truly, I just always find it so incredibly interesting the way that These categorizations you talk there about, so there is an extended scene where Winona has to meet an appointment with her doctor and how that plays out. And it has this tremendously isolating sense, I found. So very much got the sense of Winona feeling herself in becoming more and more just the individual and losing that sense of society. And that played out also in a large way across the novel. We made reference to Winona's time, her sense of time. It's not measured out in coffee spoons or even the tolling of bells, but through the buzzing of texts and reminders, and where, you know, a bell, a shared sort of experience of a quarter hour tolling or a social ritual, where they're communal, Winona's digital intrusions, like, they feel frustratingly personal. Have we lost that sense of shared time and that I guess that more sort of social sharing of experience?
I think it's interesting, and I was actually just thinking about rituals and the loss of that this morning. I think we share a lot, but I think you're very right to say we don't share time, because we share on social media, we share images, we share updates and things, but we're not experiencing them at the same time. It is a very personal situation. Your phone buzzes when it buzzes. But there's also this idea that a single individual or situation can impose their personal time on someone else's personal time much more easily with these electronic reminders and spreadsheets and ticks. And I think a lot of the book, you know, you mentioned the doctor's appointment, it's about her gradual isolation. So then the voices get louder, because she no longer understands how she can participate properly in society whilst inhabiting the moment. She's constantly drawn out of it in her mind. And so she's more and more isolated, and things like the doctors, you know, it fits her less and less. She doesn't feel understood at all. She feels more and more invisible. And in a way, her invisibility is her protection. So she says, you know, she vanishes in pieces to protect the whole of her. That's why she's also fragmenting, so that she can't be pinned down. But that comes at a cost as well.
There's an enormous sense of tragedy too, because I think, as you say, as Winona is feeling more isolated, I think the experience of knowing her for the reader is becoming more personal. And the more we know of Winona, the more, no matter how different our experience might be. And I mean, look, I'm probably not as far away from Winona as I could be, but I'm a guy, for starters. A lot of the social pressures that we have been discussing just do not fall on my shoulders. And yet I felt closer to her, but realized that as we feel close, we are in our little siloed spaces, and the stories, the narratives, the shared experiences do not often allow us to kind of reach out and touch people who are not fitting into that kind of dominant narrative that Winona is struggling to be a part of.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the bonds that would unite us, we don't know how to reach out of those shells. And I suppose, and it goes back to what I was saying in the beginning, that what I'd like is to people to want to pay rapt attention, for people to want to see. I'm not going to tell them what to look at, but it's just like, please, just notice, think about it. You know, that like I was saying, we contain multitudes, and that we want to see the humanity in each other. And even if it's just in the tiny gestures, it can make all the difference to breaking that silo that you talk about, and saying, you know, it's not as lonely as it, it doesn't need to be this lonely, I suppose.
So how to approach the next question? I've written in my notes, how to address the husband, the gaslighting, the Zersetzung, I hope I pronounced that correctly, or even approximated it. I don't want to dive into the action here, because spoilers, so much as I wanted to address the fact of Winona's marriage and her life with her husband existing in contrast to her life before, a life she at one point describes as a beautiful life lived elsewhere. Is this something we can meaningfully address before readers have even had the chance to, you know, discover this novel?
I feel like it needs to come at the point at which it comes, because we get to know her before there are any preconceptions. I think that's why it's so deeply interior, so straight, so quickly in the book, because the minute you start to put, let's call them marker points, around someone's experience, they're read a certain way. So in a way, it's important that her past life comes when it does in the book. And also that her experience in her married life. It's like a weather system, because that's how it feels. And the specifics, in a way, they matter, but they don't matter. That's why it's been done that way for a reason.
You're allowed to say, no, actually, we can't meaningfully address it. Give it 5 years, let people talk about it, and we'll, you know, when the first PhD about Thunderhead and Mrs. Dalloway comes out, then we can meaningfully have this conversation.
Well, I'd like to let this news, I'd like to let it percolate the way, just the way it is. I want to see, you know, if I've done what I think I've been able to do or not, or if I start to talk too much about it, it might colour the experience somehow. It's supposed to be expansive and inviting so many conversations and so many people into it. Basically, an antidote to the reductive forces of society that surround Winona and all of us, and thinking and keeping very broad minds and all of that. So
I completely, and look, in many ways, when I get to do Final Draft, I think I have one of the best jobs in the world, because I get to love books and then I get to speak to incredible people like you about them. But one of the hardest parts is that this book is not even a baby in the world. As at the time of our speaking, it is approaching bookshelves. But yeah, so there are things we can't talk about. Maybe one day we'll get together and we'll talk about them again.
I don't mean to be secretive, but you know.
You're not loud. Oh my goodness.
It's not a big secret. It's just, you know.
But it is, thematically, it is hard when we want people to discover this fresh. I thought perhaps then, Miranda, we could close with a mention of the Transcendence Project, which threads throughout the novel. I loved sort of discovering it. So throughout the novel, Winona strives to, I guess, crack out of the shell of her daily existence and connect in some way with the soul of the world around her. It's a beautiful idea, but in trying to realize it, Winona seems to, I guess, be constantly diminished in the eyes of others. Again, hard to ask about. So I wondered, perhaps I could say, do you have your own Transcendence Project that allows you to connect with your world?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm a great one for doing my private social experiments. So I have that, I guess, a little bit in common with Winona. So, and I did always seek to try to, like you say, to crack out of that quotidian, day-to-day, task-orientated experience into something else. And for me, and for the book as well, I'm always trying to evoke a sense of wonder. That's why you'll see Winona's giddy heights and all of that in the supermarket, which is the hub of the Transcendence Project, because it is the most untranscendent place that you think of at the time, you know. And so she's seeking to move through that, to look with strange eyes, to find the humanity in the other shoppers, to see the glory that is the human experience. And she's trying to unite what she calls the bliss and the bale. So she's got the everyday, this trolley, and then she's got up here the giddy heights of heaven. And she's saying, how can she draw the two together so that it creates a third state in which both can coexist? So you can take your trolley, but be aware of the wonder, but still do your tasks. So that's sort of what the Transcendence Project aims to do. So it's not a small project, but she takes it on in a little gutsy way, it comes up against some roadblocks, shall we say. It's not always understood by those around her, but she doesn't mind. She's going to persist. Nothing's going to stop her seeking the wonder and the joy in things, you know.
Just as you were speaking there, describing the sort of the radiance of the heaven and then the depths of the supermarket, I think I painted in my head a sort of a wonderful Michelangelo fresco of the expanse.
Yes, exactly that.
And well, does she achieve it? Who can say? I'm not going to, but I mean, perhaps the point is in the attempt, and it's perhaps one of the things that sets Winona apart. Perhaps that's why we're following her story.
I think it is in the attempt, and I think, you know, it's something that it would be nice to think about when the fear sets in, when things are glum, to reawaken the sense of wonder. It's the antidote. Mm. You know, joy and wonder are the antidote to fear. And I think that's what we, if I can say, we need more of, you know. And it's just almost a reminder. It's a permission slip. It's an encouragement. And it's a template. You know, if she can do that, and yes, it's silly and we laugh at her, but at the same time, do we not a little bit want to try something similar ourselves and see what happens. So again, it's curiosity, because I'm a big fan of curiosity. I think it's we can be curious about others and the worlds of others and the world around us. It's one of the great steps towards solutions rather than problems. And so I suppose I want people to get curious about, well, not only curious about the people around them, curious about themselves, with that expansive energy that comes with it.
Miranda, it's been tremendous to have this opportunity to speak about Thunderhead. I am discussing Thunderhead. It is a new novel from Miranda Darling. Miranda, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you so much, Andrew. It was such a pleasure.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you for joining me. Thank you for coming to the Final Draft podcast to get your dose of books, writing, and literary culture. My name is Andrew Bopel, and Final Draft is recorded on the lands of the Darug and the Gunungurra people. I love being able to present this to you. I want to shout out, if you're a podcast listener, you might not know, we come from the studios of 2SER, which is in Sydney, Australia, but we go out across Australia on the Community Radio Network. Hundreds of radio stations across the country just promoting, boosting, giving access to incredible voices from their community and other communities. This is the sort of diversity that creates a healthy, vibrant media landscape. Thank you to the Community Radio Network for supporting us, and thank you everywhere, wherever in Australia and the world you are listening. Thank you for supporting the show. The show is produced and presented by Andrew Popel, of course. I'm Andrew Popel, and I would love to hear from you. Stay in touch on social media, but also if you are just looking to discover great new Australian books, hit subscribe wherever you are. Just click whatever thing. It probably says follow or subscribe. That means you get new episodes, and it means, people go, hey, this is a valuable show. Let's listen. I've said too much. I haven't said enough. I am Andrew Popel. I'm going to be back with more incredible conversations with Australian writers very soon. Till then, happy reading. Bye for now.